And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, the future of public media. The Trump administration wants to eliminate public funding for NPR and PBS. So what will that mean for public media here in Maryland? I'll speak with the leaders of WEAA over at Morgan State, Maryland Public Television, and Delmarva Public Media about what the future holds for non-commercial stations. That's on the way tomorrow on Midday. And now a conversation about Baltimore's population, which has been in decline, generally speaking, for about 70 years. Last month, the U.S. Census Bureau released data indicating that Baltimore's population had inched up by fewer than 800 people in 2024. And as trends go, that's the right direction. But what needs to happen for that trend to be sustained? Joining me now is Charlie Duff, an architectural historian and developer in Baltimore who is the retired chair and president of Jubilee Baltimore, a nonprofit organization that builds affordable and market-rate housing throughout the city. And Charlie Duff joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you, sir.
Tom, good to see you. Good to be visible.
And listeners, you are welcome to chime in. What do you think about the fact that the population of Baltimore, at least by the measure of the last report from the Census Department, inched up a bit? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So you wrote a piece a while back in the Baltimore, it was either the Sun or the Banner, I can't remember now.
It was the Sun.
The Sun. And you said that one of the focuses that you're interested in is not necessarily the population number, which right now hovers a little bit below 600,000 in Baltimore, but households, the number of households. So explain, right. Walk us through that. What does the number of households have to do with the overall population, and why should we pay attention?
Well, back in 1950, when Baltimore City had its largest ever population, the average Baltimore City household had 3.3 people in it. And that was also the average household for the United States. Today, the average Baltimore City household has 2.2 people in it. And that's also more or less the average for the United States. What this means is that if you've got the same number of households you had in 1950, you're going to have a third fewer people because each household is about one-third smaller than it used to be.
Yeah, and in 1950, we were almost at a million people here in
1950,
Baltimore.
We were almost at a million people. That's right. And we had, you know, a lot of households, but there were a lot of people living in each household. And if you talk to people who grew up in Baltimore in the 1950s, and I'm one, there were a lot of kids in small houses. There were, you know, a lot of people took in boarders, all your grandparents lived with you, all kinds of stuff. Households were bigger than they are now. So if you are, say, if you're running a food store, you want to have an awful lot of people. But suppose you want to build a neighborhood, or suppose you want to rebuild Baltimore's vacant houses. Population is not really what you're interested in. What you're really interested in is the number of households. If you want to fix up a vacant house and get somebody to buy it or rent it, you don't care whether it's one person or a family with 16 kids. A household is a household. And Baltimore City has been, we say, losing population for a long time, since 1950. The funny thing is, Baltimore City has almost as many households as it did in 1950.
Just fewer people per
Just
household.
Just fewer people
And this
per
is
household.
Because in the 50s, I mean, you had mothers-in-laws and fathers-in-laws living with families. You had people staying at home until they got married. Whereas now, you know, if you're 22 years old, you graduate from college, your first instinct is not to move back in with mom and dad. Sometimes you have to do that. But if you don't, if you have a job, you want to go rent your own apartment or maybe an apartment with some other friends who would, you know, make that household, you know, two, three, four people. But the reasons that people that the households are smaller are cultural as much as anything else, right?
And the reasons that households are smaller are good things. There are sort of two reasons our households are smaller. One is we live longer, and the other is we're richer. And because we're richer, we're able to live on our own when we're young, and we're able to live on our own when we're old. My grandparents lived with my parents, but my parents didn't live with me. They didn't have to. We got richer. And this happened
because they were able to save enough for retirement that sustained them on their own without.
Right, and they had Social Security, among other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've done a lot. So all the things you describe have made it possible to have smaller households.
And there was a housing shortage after the war. You wrote about that, and it took a good bit of time to address that, to build enough houses. To get out of that shortage. What caused the shortage of houses? I mean, or perhaps I should say, was the shortage of houses a reason that each household was bursting at the seams?
Yeah, sure it was. And there were two reasons there was a housing shortage. The Depression and World War II. People didn't build very much during the Depression, and they built almost nothing during World War II, except ships and tanks and aircraft. Meanwhile, the population kept growing, and the population moved around. People talk about the Great Migration of African Americans from the South to the North. Well, that actually happened, and it was about 10 million people. And they moved from the South to northern cities. But in those northern cities, and Baltimore was one, there was the Depression. There was the war. Nobody built anything. So you get the phenomenon of houses getting cut up into apartments and people piling in. And it took 20 years, more than 20 years, for the United States to work off its housing shortage. And then we did. And then in many places, we wound up with a housing surplus. The classic case is Detroit, where Detroit kept building after they had made up for the housing shortage, and they wound up with about 300,000 houses and apartments more than they had households. So the city of Detroit wound up with 300,000 vacant houses, lost 300,000 households of people who moved to the suburbs. Baltimore had the same thing. Everybody had the same thing. Nobody had it as bad as Detroit. So,
when you say we made up the deficit of housing, mm-hmm. And it took about 20 years. Is that 20 years, does that clock start ticking in 1945 at the end of the war?
Starts ticking at the end of the war.
So by the middle of the 1960s, we sort of caught up with housing. We had a commensurate number of households in need of a house and houses to buy.
Right. And then Baltimore, metropolitan Baltimore, the city and the suburban counties, kept overproducing housing at some moderate rate. But the reason the city lost population was mainly because it had the same number of households and the households got smaller. Now, the city also got poorer. There were things that happened that were objectively bad for the city and for the citizens.
There was white flight. Right?
There was white flight. There was middle class flight. And there was middle-class flight long before there was white flight. People say, what caused white flight? I said it was mainly cars and money. That, America has a very strong social norm that moving up means moving out. And as people got richer, they wanted to move farther out. And they did.
And, of course, in recent years, it's been black flight from the city of Baltimore, again, for the reasons that as the black middle class grows, they're abandoning the city for the perceived joys of the suburbs.
It's middle class flight. Mm-hmm. It can be white, black, brown. It's middle class flight. It's a strong social norm in America. And it's taken a long time for anything to make that better for the city or for other cities. The tide has finally begun to turn, and you really notice it in New York City. New York City has gained 1.5 million people in the last 30 years. I can remember when whole huge parts of the Bronx and of Harlem and of Brooklyn were vacant and really looked like the end of World War II. No vacant units in New York, and New York is spilling over, and it's energizing places like Newark, New Jersey, which...
Yeah, Hoboken, Jersey City, you know, all those places.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
right.
And Washington is energizing Baltimore.
And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the fact that actually the number of households in Baltimore in the last 5 years or so has actually begun to increase. And I want to talk about why that is. Charlie Duff is the retired chair and president of Jubilee Baltimore. It's a nonprofit housing organization. We're talking about our city's population and what we can do to increase it. You can join us 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org when we return with Charlie Duff after a quick break. But before we go to that break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 38 people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city. Police have identified 3 people who died last week. They are Hakeem English, age 35, Paris Savage, age 30, and Darius Bunch. He was 32 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, we're talking about Baltimore's population and housing challenges. The city's population peaked back in 1950 at just under 1 million people. As of the 2020 census, we now have fewer than 600,000 residents. My guest is the architectural historian and urban planner Charlie Duff, who led Jubilee Baltimore, a nonprofit housing organization, for many years. You can join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So, Charlie, as I teased before we went to a break, there has, in fact, been an uptick in the number of households. You quote something called the American Communities Service, which is a survey, rather, which is part of the U.S. Census. Which says that between 2018 and 2022, Baltimore gained 17,500 households. Right. So that seems like a lot of households to me in a 3 or 4 year period.
That's a lot of households. And in fact, we kept it up. We've kept it up for the last 6 years. And over those 6 years, the city has gained 9.5% of all the households that it has. And that's kind of in the league. It's not quite Seattle. It's not quite Phoenix, but it's certainly a Sun Belt number. It's a successful number.
Did the census get it wrong when they said that we have fewer than 600,000 people? Do you believe that number?
Nobody believes the census population numbers for big old cities. They're driven by algorithms. Nobody takes them seriously. They could be right. They could be wrong. But their methodology is so strange that nobody believes them, and I would encourage everybody in the WYPR listening audience not to worry too much about whether the census says Baltimore is gaining people or losing people. People are hard to count. The census just does samples, and their samples are imprecise. Households are much easier to count. And when the census says that Baltimore City is gaining 22,500 households over a period of 6 years, you can pretty well take that to the bank. And that's, you know, again, almost 10% of all the households in the city. Not only that, there's a little more good news on that. Some of you out there in Radio Land are probably saying, oh, yeah, sure, You know, there are a lot of new apartments down near the harbor, new apartments downtown. Rich neighborhoods are getting richer. That's all this is.
Yeah, a lot of banks, you know, all of a sudden are being converted into apartments. You see all
that stuff
over the place.
All that stuff, that's happening. And that accounts for about half of the new households in Baltimore City.
So the other half is coming from...
The other half is coming from the neighborhoods. And the, you know, the number of vacant houses on the city's vacant building list is going down by about 1,000 a year. There aren't any vacant houses in the list in Canton or Roland Park. And vacant houses are a symptom of neighborhood weakness. And you find them in neighborhoods that people have been moving out of voluntarily. That tide is beginning to reverse. Markets are getting dramatically stronger in neighborhoods that have been falling apart for years. And that's about half of the city's gain
in
household.
That is good news. So we're talking about places like, what, Edmondson West Side or Poppleton, or where are we talking about?
Yeah, all of the above. And I just had breakfast this morning with former Housing Commissioner Michael Braverman. He said, it's happening everywhere. It's happening citywide. It's happening to houses that were vacant, but it's also happening to houses that would have become vacant. You know, a little old lady goes into a nursing home and her house doesn't have the little old lady anymore, so what happens to it? There are lots of neighborhoods where 10 years ago that house would have wound up on the vacant buildings list, mm-hmm. and now somebody buys it and fixes it up and sells it or rents it. That's
And there's places like Oliver where that's happening, where there's an absolute concomitant reduction in violence and crime, too, as well. I mean, you've got places where the housing stock is risen, people are moving in, you find that in terms of public safety, it's a much better place to live than it was at one time.
I couldn't agree more. I think the best crime reduction strategy is repopulating neighborhoods.
What do you make of the vacancy rate? The American Community Service survey, again, says that the rate has dropped nearly 16% in the past 5 years. I had the mayor on a couple of weeks ago who said we're down to a little more than 13,000 vacants, just under 14,000 vacant houses. How does that number compare to previous years? And how does the vacancy rate fit into this puzzle of gaining households?
Well, every year, the builders and developers of Baltimore are rebuilding about 1,000 vacant houses net. That's a net number. Some houses are still going vacant, but the, you know, the net number is a reduction in vacancy of about 1,000 a year. So that's pretty cool stuff. Also, in neighborhoods all over town, houses that used to go vacant are not going vacant anymore. For many years, every time we fixed up a house, we were filling a leaky bucket. And the bucket's not leaky anymore, and that's a big help. And then also when houses come up for sale, they're not empty as long. They sell faster. When apartments come up for rent, they're not empty as long. So we're gaining in a number of different ways.
And you actually predict that by 2030, that's only in 5 years, if these trends continue, we will have more households than we had back in 1950. You're saying at the moment we have about the same number, and because there's fewer people per house, we have fewer people in the city. But we could actually increase the number of households by building a bunch more houses to exceed what we had 70 years ago.
We have been on a track to do that. Now, the economy at the moment is Fruit Loops, and nobody knows what's going on, and nobody is more afraid of making big capital investments than developers. So I don't know what's going to happen. To a great extent, Baltimore's revival is spillover from metropolitan Washington. That's not a stronger job market for the immediate future. I don't want anybody in the audience here to stop thinking that Baltimore needs to work. Baltimore needs to work, needs to get to work, needs to figure out what it needs to do.
There is, and what you're saying we need to do is build a bunch more houses.
We need to build a bunch
building more houses. The houses, getting rid of, because there still is a housing shortage. We have all these vacant houses,
right?
But we still have a shortage. So it's like those two things can't get reconciled together.
Right. And, you know, if you say, gee, there's a housing shortage, the region needs to build more housing, and I say, you're right, and that new housing should be built in the city where people can walk and ride buses and, you know, have an urbane life with a small carbon footprint, so and not mess up the suburban landscape. So all of those things are, you know, Baltimore is still in 28 flavors of trouble, but it's finally got some things that are going our way, and refilling neighborhoods, getting rid of vacant property, restoring confidence. So much of this is about confidence. If you're living in a neighborhood that's falling apart around your eyes, are you going to stand up for community standards? No. Are you going to respect your neighborhood association leaders? No. You remember when the Orioles were losing 2/3 of their games? How many people bought tickets? You know, being in a declining neighborhood is like cheering for a losing team.
Yeah, success breeds success.
Yeah.
But it sounds like overall, Charlie, you're pretty optimistic. You sound pretty sanguine about the chances of us turning this around as a city.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've been working at this in a really serious way for 50 years. And that's about how long it takes. American cities got into a very deep hole after World War II, and it's taken every one of them a long time to get out of it, including us.
All right. Well, we are going to leave on that optimistic note, and I am grateful to you for coming in and talking us through. Thank you.
Well, I'm grateful to you for making me a star. Thank you so much.
That's right. You've always been a star, Charlie, and always shall be. Charlie Duff, an urban planner and the retired chair and president of Jubilee Baltimore. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with the leaders of three public media outlets in Maryland about the future of the public media model as an information resource for urban, suburban, and rural communities throughout the state. And coming up next on Fresh Air, Terry Gross speaks with Stephen Levitsky about the state of U.S. democracy today and the historical comparison to other countries where democracy has been under threat. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Have a great day.